This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is South Carolina artist West Fraser. I call him a South Carolina artist, even though he was born in Georgia. He spent much of his life in the Palmetto State, and really much of his work, his paintings, have to do with the Carolina Lowcountry. West, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter. It's a pleasure to be here.
In the introduction to your book, Painting the Southern Coast, and I think we might want to define how you say the Southern Coast, you have a very specific geographical limitation on that.
I do. The title was researched, and that was the best title to come up with, but it's actually the coast of what's called the Georgia Bight. So speaking of Georgia, but the Georgia Bight includes the curvature and the dip on the east coast, the southeast coast, between Cape Canaveral and Cape Fear. So most of the book encompasses the geography from Georgetown to St. Augustine, Florida.
For those of us from the other southern coast on the Gulf, I just wanted to make sure that we got the idea of what you defined as the coast. And it also is, historically, you could say that's rice country, which it was in the 18th century. Even down into Florida, people forget that they grew rice in Florida. In fact, Henry Lawrence had some big rice plantations down there. But given that title, the two introductory essays by art historians raise a term that, quite frankly, I never heard to describe your work. And it's French, and I think you might call it plein air.
It is plein air. It's painting in the open air. Today, it's overused and become very popularized, Walter. So I'm shying away from it a little bit, but it is definitely a major part of my method.
Well, what about your being described as a modern impressionist?
That would be accurate. It's very hard to label art today. I've followed my true nature and painted the way that I felt most comfortable. So I sort of describe myself as a naturalistic impressionist American painter.
Okay. Well, now that we've got the style down right, let's talk a little bit about you.
Okay.
Your hometown was actually Hinesville, but that's not where you were born.
Well, Hinesville did not have a hospital. My father was born in Hinesville in the old family home there, but I was, my mother went to Savannah, to the Telfair Hospital, where I was born.
And at some point, your family moved to Hilton Head.
We moved to Hilton Head in the early 60s from Hinesville. My father had gone there in the 50s to run a timber camp for his father, where they cut timber, big timber, from Hilton Head. And in fact, Walter, the beams were put on barges and sent to Europe to help rebuild Europe after the Second World War.
So we're talking probably longleaf pine?
Yeah, big long beams.
Okay. And so you ended up spending much of your childhood on Hilton Head.
I went across on a ferry before the Burns Bridge was built in 56. So I'd been going there all my life.
Well, that was the period when Hilton Head, after the timber, when Hilton Head began to be developed as a resort. And somewhere in my readings, you had a little bit of ambivalence about that because the natural island was your playground.
Well, when I moved there, I had come from South Georgia near Savannah, where we had free reign over large tracts of land with horses and vehicles, and then we moved to Hilton Head. We still took our horses, and we had plenty of vehicles and a lot of land. And so it was like a playground. Only on Hilton Head, we had a beach, and I had the creeks and the waterways more readily available. My father and my uncle started a development called Sea Pines. Mm-hmm. And so I was there in the thick of it. And so in the early days, as a child, you know, I was building tree forts and playing in the woods and things. So, yes, I believe that the early development and the impact on me as a romantic spirit did affect me, probably deeply affected me, and it led to part of this approach I take to painting. And what I do is almost, it's not really documentary, but it borders on that documentation of place.
In your own introduction, you describe yourself as a son of the Lowcountry. In fact, West, I'm going to ask you to read that paragraph where you describe yourself as a son of the Lowcountry.
I'll be happy to. I am a son of the Lowcountry, a land along the coast of Georgia and South Carolina, defined by history and geography. Since childhood, my passion has been to capture, in paint, a portrait of this place I call my country. It is a place where daily the tide rises to meet a jungle-like land, caressed by humid air, pungent with the aroma of decay. The seasonal colors in the landscape are subtle, and the natural shapes are organic and ephemeral. The songs of the environment ring powerful and archaic. The palmettos chattering in a cool spring breeze, the great blue heron's guttural complaints meeting the ebb and flow rhythm of the tides flooding the vast Spartina marshes. It all courses through my veins. It is a sensuous feeling, and it draws those of us born here back home again. My ancestors worked the land and used its resources to advantage, and today I reverently use this same region for inspiration. I find my muse here in the Lowcountry.
That's beautiful, and I would say a couple of those images, if you weren't painting, you might try poetry. The palmettos chattering in the cool breeze, and then the great blue heron's guttural complaints, meeting the ebb and flow rhythm of the tides. You've got pluff mud in your soul. I mean, it's
I do, and oftentimes, you know, if you startle a great blue heron, he'll fly over you, just going, and it's a archaic sound. And, you know, all of those things that occur while I'm spending, Walter, I'll go out and paint. I'll stand on the edge of the marsh or in the marsh or, you know, for hours at a time. And so I'm there while all the wildlife is moving around. And because I'm there doing what I do, I'm not interrupting their space. I'm in the environment. And standing there working silently, I become one in the place. And so it's amazing the different things you see of creatures and seasonal patterns that you experience while you're there in the environment.
In your description of that, just conjured up an image in my mind, comparing that to the 19th century French painters who went out to do their landscapes, Millet and even the Impressionist, standing there in the field in their smocks and what have you. You've probably got on waders and jeans. And as you say, you're a boy of the Lowcountry, so you're going to wear what it takes. You don't have to get up in, quote, painter outfits. No beret.
No, in fact, smudge pots to burn to make some smoke to keep the biting gnats away. And definitely I've gone through several pairs of waders and, access by boat. Yes, it's not a glamorous setting.
And you mentioned the boat, and I think the story of the boat is something we ought to talk about too, because eventually, it's a while from age 13 when you told an aunt that you were going to be an artist, before you ended up getting back in South Carolina in the mid-80s, just before Hugo. So let's talk about that part of your life, your training, and why you made the kind of adventures into New York, Pennsylvania, California.
Well, Walter, growing up on Hilton Head, my heroes as far as art went were some illustrators that had moved there from New York, and they had been famous illustrators, Kobe Whitmore, Joe Bowler, and they had done, you know, glamorous work for Ladies Home Journal and Red Book, and in their time, they were the image makers, the popular cultural image makers. So they were, like, Kobe would tell me, people would stop him on the street and say, "Oh my God, can I have your autograph?" So from their stories, and also when I went to school, I first started at Clemson. I went to College of Charleston. I thought I was going to be a biologist. I did study quite a bit of biology, but mostly in the natural history realms by choice. And it was this thing that was always driving me to make decisions. Finally gave that idea up and went to the University of Georgia to study art, not really knowing exactly what I was getting into. Ended up being choosing to go into the commercial art school, graphic design and illustration, because I was being practical, thinking of what it might take to make a living. So after that, I always thought that I needed to go to New York to cut my teeth, and commercial illustration would be a great way to make a living or whatever. And I went there. By then, in the late 70s and early 80s, illustration was sort of dying out.
Yes, we're getting into the age of computers and not quite digitalization.
But photography had already taken over from illustration. There were a few applications, but not that many. But I always had in the back of my head I wanted to be a painter, and so and I'd already started making paintings and selling paintings. So I went to New York, but the closest I could get to the city and feel comfortable about being there was this. I found a place in Pennsylvania, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Longtime art community, theater community in Bucks County.
Famous. I didn't know it when I moved there.
You didn't know about the Bucks County Playhouse?
No. No, but when I got there, I discovered the Pennsylvania Impressionist, and it opened up a whole new world of art to me that I really was not aware of. They don't teach that in art school.
Well, when you were at the University of Georgia, didn't the art department bring in some ultra-modernist icon, and that's what everybody was looking at?
Well, the head of the department was Elaine de Kooning.
Okay.
So her husband, de Kooning, was one of the great abstract expressionists.
Yeah. But that wasn't anything that interested you particularly.
It naturally did not fit.
Okay.
No.
Departments, whether they're history or art, all go through certain phases where this is what they're pushing. And was commercial art kind of the orphan member of the department? Or?
Well, it was sort of. There's definitely a difference between fine art and commercial art. I went there because there was an illustrator there that could teach me how to construct and make an image, what I say, to make a painting.
Okay. All right. And so you decided to go to New York. Did you actually do any commercial art for a while? I mean, did you get some?
Yes, I had an agent on Madison Avenue, and she sent me jobs. But I continued to paint and started a project. I call it a project. I started a series of New England harbors. And so I bought a little inflatable boat and put a 25 horsepower motor on it, and it would go about 40 miles an hour. So I would go up to New England and trailer it and put the boat in the water and drive around all these harbors. And I've loved boats all of my life. And I've been a boater forever, and it was just absolutely beautiful to me, these old colonial villages along the sea with beautiful yachts. And I started doing paintings of these harbors, and I got an exhibition at the Grand Central Art Gallery on 57th Street, and they were the oldest representational gallery in New York. They had represented people, my heroes, like Winslow Homer, William Merritt Chase, and the names go on and on and on. So it was a fantastic beginning.
And when you say representational art, you're referring to your style.
Yes, representational art is imagery that you understand by looking at it, as opposed to an abstracted image or even a non-objective abstraction of, or non-objective okay. art has no imagery whatsoever.
Okay. Well, that, you know, that's pretty good. A young man, a young artist, gets picked up by one of the major galleries in New York. Did your agent help you do that, or did you walk in the door? And
I actually walked in the door with photographs to show, and then they called me back and gave me an exhibition and started selling paintings.
Okay. And so that kind of made your decision, is that's what you're going to shift from commercial to?
That I did decide that I was going to be a painter. I gave up illustration, and but it also set in motion, what kind of an artist am I going to be? Am I going to be a Pennsylvania artist? Am I going to be a Yankee artist?
Oh, heaven forbid.
And what am I going to do? And at the same time, I found a book on Tom Thompson, who's a Canadian artist. And he was the inspiration for the Group of Seven in Canada, which is the iconic Canadian art movement. And Tom Thompson painted the Algonquin Park, and he called it my country. And after reading his story, his short life of painting Algonquin Park and establishing the imagery that spurred a movement in Canada for decades, it's a very famous group. It inspired me to come home to my country to paint my region, South Carolina, Georgia, ultimately leading to the publication of this book of work I've done for the last 35 years.
Was it that point where you had a successful art show that made you decide, I'm giving up commercial illustration, or had you already begun in your mind to move away from that?
Walter, my goal always was to be a painter.
Okay.
So the illustration was, I knew was a process, a place that I felt I needed to go. But once I realized that I had representation in a very fine gallery in New York City, then I could probably start moving towards the fine art of to be a painter that I wanted to do.
And at this time, you were working in watercolor, right?
I was working in watercolor.
Now, that's not easy.
It's probably the most difficult medium. These were big watercolors, and very intricate and very detailed, with towns and boats and all this stuff going on. And at the time, I worked from photographs. I took my own photographs, and I would go on these trips, and then I would come home and work up these big watercolors. Eventually, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to get out of the studio and out into to the open air.
Most people do think watercolors maybe being 8x10 or even smaller, but some of yours are about 3 or 39 inches, are they?
Yeah, they sometimes went up to 4.5 feet.
So you got back to South Carolina and 84, 85?
Yes.
And you started painting, but now you switched to oils?
No, I was still painting in watercolor when we moved to Charleston. And when I came here, you know, I knew that I wanted to paint the Lowcountry. Obviously, Charleston was a great choice. I saw lots of potential in Charleston, which it has shown that it was probably a pretty good choice. since Charleston is booming, mm-hmm. I had to figure out my approach to how I paint the Lowcountry. So I was still working in watercolor, and I was still using photographs. I had sort of started because of the knowing about the Pennsylvania Impressionist and being introduced to that work. I started working outdoors a little bit, but Hurricane Hugo changed all of that.
Okay, and how so?
Well, it affected my life dramatically. My studio was out of commission for about 6 months, and I also had a divorce. Mm-hmm. And that I just said, I'm going to change the way I do things. And I started painting outdoors all the time in watercolor, and then I soon shifted to painting in oil.
Okay. Now, for those of us who are not artists, the techniques would seem to be different.
The approaches and techniques are completely opposite. So in a watercolor, you go from light to dark. And in an oil painting, you go from dark to light. So my training in oil was almost nil. I asked my friends on Hilton Head, the illustrators, for some advice, and they said, Wes, it's the opposite of watercolors. You know how to paint watercolor, and oils are just a different way. And so the dark passages are thin, and the light passages are thick, and that's what I had to go by.
So in this case, you were really self-taught.
I'm predominantly self-taught.
Okay. That's something that I find fascinating. I mean, you did go to the University of Georgia, got a degree in from the art department, but you didn't go to France, you didn't join the New York Art School or anything like that. It's an unusual path, because everybody likes to rack up, well, I did studio time here, 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 and you just did it. Man, I think that's great.
Well, I'm kind of hard-headed that way. I just do it my own way. But what I think that for a long time I thought I was at a disadvantage because I didn't have the art school training from an atelier or, you know, where you are under the tutelage of painters and they teach you their technique. But I think it was ultimately an advantage because my style is my style. My approach to what I do is my approach. And the body of work I've done is the product of a true compassion for who I am and the place I live.
And when we talk about the place you live, and we're not just talking about the natural beauty because that's part of it, but you deal with a landscape for you can be a street scene. It can be a fishing shack. It's landscape in the largest sense.
Yes, you're right. It is broadly defined and quite a bit of variety. So in my most recent exhibition at the Gibbs Museum, there's a room of about 30 paintings. And none of the paintings are repeating themselves. They all have their own certain characteristic or look or subject matter, or they're all just completely different. And that's kind of the odd thing about my work, is it can't be pigeonholed. It is that way because I'm very specific about where I paint. In fact, in my book, Painting the Southern Coast, did you notice that every color plate has a longitude and latitude designating exactly where the paintings were painted?
I have read through the book. I did not note that. One thing I did note at the beginning of each section, you have an index for what's going to follow.
The beginning of each is a list of the paintings mm-hmm. by number, and the numbers are pinpointed on the little map. So you can see, on a coastal island, like, say, Cumberland Island, Georgia, mm-hmm. you can see all around the island, all the places where I painted the picture.
Why did you decide you wanted to put the longitude and latitude? Is that because you're a boater?
chose to put the longitude and latitude because it goes back to that childhood experience and wanting to capture this place that I love so much. Through all the work I've done in the Lowcountry, it's about the place as much as it is about the art. So it's almost a contradiction, but it's just the way that I've done it. So if I'm trying to introduce somebody to a place, then I'm telling them exactly where it is. If I'm doing a painting, it really should not matter where it is. The painting matters. So there is a contradiction in there, but nevertheless, I think that this book is sort of a journey that I'm introducing people to.
Also, since you've had this drive or vision of, since you were a child, and your concern about what has happened to the coast over your lifetime, by putting the longitude and latitude, and your paintings are all dated as well, you know that this is a Charleston street scene in a particular area in 1989. Or if it had been before, if it had been pre-Hugo, then people would understand that too. And the same would apply for the coast with Hurricane Matthew that came through, did tremendous damage to the maritime forests and the dunes and what have you. But you've got paintings of those before the storm.
Yes. You mentioned the storms. So Hurricane Hugo, I said, was dramatic for many, many people. Terribly destructive of the landscape around Charleston. And I have another book with the University of South Carolina Press called Charleston in My Time. It's published in 2001. That is strictly of the Charleston area. Post-Hurricane Hugo, so the last decade of the 20th century, and post-Hurricane Hugo, I started painting the city because you could see the buildings. It didn't have the draping oak limbs and all the trees and all the things that used to block the view of the buildings, etc. So it was a more difficult urban environment to paint. But right after Hugo, it opened it up, and I painted and painted and painted. Now, to today, the paintings I've done, the landscapes predominantly along the coast, you know, I had to go south to find an undisturbed landscape because you probably remember the tree line. If you looked across the water and you saw a tree line in the distance, after Hugo, it was like a bunch of sticks sticking up. So it had no more form. It was completely destroyed. So I went into Beaufort County quite a bit, and I went into the islands of Georgia to find this landscape that I call the Lowcountry. And as you mentioned before, it was all the tidal region and all the rice-growing region. And it's all the same environment of oaks and palmettos and cedars and magnolias, the maritime forest. You know, that goes all the way down to the St. John's River.
Getting around, and that's where I wanted to talk about your boat. After Hugo, you don't have your little inflatable dinghy anymore. You've got a real sailboat.
Yes, I bought a salvage from Hugo, a 36-foot Robert Perry designed double ender sailboat, the kind of boat you could sail around the world. I never got to that, but I did. I sailed into the South Carolina, Georgia region with that. Later, I bought a motor cruiser, a fast trawler that was 38 feet with twin diesels, and I used that to go into these areas to paint as well, which was great fun. I would take artist friends, and we would go on these 2-3-week journeys and anchor off the shore and dinghy ashore and paint all day and come back to the boat and cook up a meal and have some nice wine or something, go to bed, wake up before sunrise, and go back to painting again. It was incredibly fun and very, very powerful experiences.
You called it the Sea Sisters, I think.
Well, Sea Sisters was my first sailboat.
Okay.
So then my other boat was called Ocella.
Okay. When you go in, are you going to set up an easel and do oils? Or are you going to make sketches and then later come back to your studio and...
For 25 years, Walter, I painted exclusively outdoors.
Okay.
In the open air.
Okay. And in terms of size, I know they vary, but in terms of manageability, what's your largest that you work on?
Well, most plein air painters do small canvases. I paint by site size. And so if I'm standing on the riverbank under an oak tree and trying to get this larger imagery, because it's site size, I had to have larger canvases. So I did work on pieces up, 30, 36 was about as big as I wanted to take into the environment, because otherwise it becomes a sail, and oftentimes larger canvases, they would go flying off into the... into the marsh. So I built boxes to hold my panels, and so anything from like a 12 by 16 up to a 30 by 40 was okay. What I was working with.
All right, West, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with South Carolina artist West Fraser about his work on the Georgia Bight, which is from St. Augustine to Georgetown. Wes, when you are going off your boat onto the shore, obviously things like light changes during the course of the day. Do you stay in one place several days so you can keep painting, or do you try to, you don't finish something in one day?
I'll try to describe a day.
Okay.
So we go ashore before sunrise and quickly try to get a painting done of sunrise, the early morning warm sun hitting the trees and moss or whatever, and how the shadows and sun hitting the marsh in the distance look. But yes, you do predominantly finish a small painting in a setting, because you have a 3-hour period of time. After that, the light changes so much that you basically, if you continue to paint longer than 3 hours, you do what I call chase the light. So you're constantly changing, the shadows and things like that. So, yes, in a small piece, that's the challenge of plein air painting, is you have to paint very fast. You have to make quick decisions.
Well, one of the influences on you as a child was your paternal grandfather. And I picked up on that because in my growing up, my paternal grandfather might have had, in fact, he had greater influence on me than my parents.
My paternal grandfather, although he was died when I was young and had suffered strokes before that, but he was a man that also greatly influenced my father and my uncle, that I had more direct influence from. So Granddad was one of those great American patriots that was in the Liberty County Independent Cavalry Troop and went to the First World War with his brother, who was the captain. Granddad was the lieutenant. Went to France in First World War. He was the liaison officer for Captain Harry Truman. A lifetime friendship after that. And then as a citizen soldier, he went back to war in the Second War and led a group of men to New Guinea for a couple of years, and then went to Europe right after the D-Day invasion and had an artillery group that made it all the way to Germany. He was the first American officer to go to Hitler's bunker. So anyway, he influenced my dad. My dad was a man of great integrity. He and his brother developed Sea Pines, and Dad was the go-to man for all the employees. He was the man that had your back. I from the age of 13, worked on construction sites, starting with my dad. And then when he stopped building and went to management of construction for the company, I continued building. And all through my high school years, I was a construction worker, and then paid for my, my spending money was made doing carpentry repair all through college.
Oh.
And I always felt like being practical, that was a practical thing to know, which led to being practical to go to art, to commercial art instead of fine art, et cetera, et cetera.
I want to talk about some of your paintings. John Stern, one of the art historians, said his favorite painting was Atlantic Moonrise on Dawes Island. So you want to give us a little bit of history on that?
I'll be happy to. And we were talking about going by boat to go painting. My favorite place, and the place that I would go almost all the time by boat, was to Dawes Island. And it's in the middle of the Port Royal Sound between Paris Island and Pinckney Island. Mm-hmm. Pinckney Island is a preserve, and Paris Island is the marine base. And Dawes Island is at the mouth of the Port Royal Sound. You know the history of Port Royal Sound. It's the deepest harbor on the East Coast, natural harbor on the East Coast. It's where the Union Navy had their southern command.
Mm-hmm.
So at one time there would have been hundreds of ships off of the head of Hilton Head. And so off to the right in the painting is Hilton, the north end of Hilton Head Island, and looking straight out the mouth in towards the Atlantic, I have a moonrise coming up over some of the little, they're called hummocks, mm-hmm. where there'll be a small microcosm of maritime forest with palmettos and an oak tree and some cedars and some of the other vegetation that grows at the edge of the salt water. And behind me are the other tree lines, and so palmettos and oaks and things are casting shadows in the foreground of the painting. So to me, the Atlantic Moonrise is really an iconic painting of the Lowcountry. It also represents to me the place that I found my muse to paint. And that was I would go there for weeks at a time, Walter, with friends or by myself, and just paint and paint and paint. Dawes Island is the perfect place for an artist to go paint because it's very small and it has lots of edges and lots of variety of terrain. And so within a 10, 15 minute walk, you can go from a sand flat to the edge of a river with palmettos to a pine forest, or so it has lots of variety with cedars and dead cedars and all sorts of things.
Well, it's wonderful that even with development, we still have places like that in South Carolina that you can enjoy.
Now, Dawes Island is now a South Carolina Heritage Trust preserve.
Okay.
Because my family donated it to the state.
Okay. Wonderful.
And so we do have still wild places where one can find inspiration.
I just picked out several that I found fascinating. And Many Springs on Hopsley Plantation was the first one I picked out because I think that's some people might say is sort of a traditional landscape.
Yes, and historically it's an important place. It has the perfectly preserved slave cabin with the scalloped edge roof board, which was what the Bermuda swag, I believe they call mm-hmm. it. This place was Thomas Lynch's plantation, and he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
So obviously it's been there for a long time. It shows the Lowcountry Spring with the redbud tree and the camellias blooming and the oak tree blooming and the golden tassels on the oak tree.
As my kids say, the worms on the oak tree.
The worms on the oak tree, yeah.
No, I guess it was because this was low country and you did have the redbud and the camellias. If you're thinking about a low country maritime forest, you don't see that bright red coloring.
No, and obviously this is a domesticated garden setting, and one of those important places, you know, along our coast.
This was hard for me in picking out, but I did pick out paintings wanted to talk about and experiences. Kendall Pond, and as I'd have to remind my students, it may be spelled Kinlaw, but the locals call it Kinlaw.
Correct, it's Kinlaw. Was Kinlaw Plantation on the Santee River, mm-hmm. was one of those iconic duck hunting plantations. And this is the pond next to the house there, full of lily pads and a bold tree line in the distance. And the sun is setting behind the tree line, giving you some bright, strong color right along the horizon from behind the trees. And then you've got the silver tones of the sky above reflected in the water below. I mean, this golden hour, this moment that I've captured in the painting only lasts about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so it really is a matter of rapidly putting in the bold reds and oranges strategically around the trees and under the trees, and then finding a few spots along the water where that would be reflected. And then I work on it in the studio, and that's where the memory comes in. You have to remember what it looked like. But ultimately, Walter, it's all about creating the illusion that a painting is. A painting is an illusion. It is not reality. So ultimately, in the studio, you have to make the decisions on how to make the painting work as a visual cue to make someone believe the illusion.
Something totally different. You've got some Charleston streetscapes, and with all due respect, these are not Elizabeth O'Neill Verner. This is not the picaresque Charleston of the Charleston Renaissance. The one I picked out was Cobbler and His Crooked Building, and two painters came to mind. One is Hopper. Mm-hmm. The other is a South Carolina artist that people don't realize that Ed Yajin painted cityscapes in Columbia and Greenville. A little bit different style, but as soon as I saw that, I thought Ed would love that.
Well, I'm glad you picked this one. Oftentimes, people are perhaps sentimental in their approach to a painting. My work has always been that I paint it, some people would call it realism or bordering on realism, because realism is where you leave the trash cans, mm-hmm. and you leave the orange cones or you know, the telephone pole. Mm-hmm. So in this painting, as in all of my paintings, it's really about composition. It's about the elements that I can put together to create a visual imagery that is of interest, where someone wants to stand in front of it and look at it and maybe take a visit or a journey through the painting. So there's elements in this painting of Cobbler and His Crooked Building, such as the orange street lamps, mm-hmm. traffic lights in the top right-hand corner, and the telephone pole that's leaning to the right, and the cobbler's, I call it the cobbler's building because it's a corner store, and the cobbler has his little shop next door, and this is the cobbler walking to his store in the morning. And he rents out the building to the corner store. Then in the distance, you have the fire truck parked along an orange building. So you've got red, orange, yellow, orange, green, and blue sky and yellow lines in the street to the left. All of it kind of works together to make a painting, but it also this place has seen so much transformation over the years. This was painted in 04. I think I did a painting of it before that, but since 04, this little corner store that catered to population in 04 that is different from the population it caters to now. So now it has fancy drinks and designer chips and the new array of beer and catering
it's become gentrified.
Become gentrified. And so many paintings I've done, you can see the transition.
No RC Cola and Moon Pies.
No RC Cola and Moon Pie.
Okay. I've got one more, and then we will have a wrap-up conversation. This is B&M Bait and Tackle at Mayport, Florida.
Right, and B&M Bait and Tackle is that iconic old gas station that you and I remember from childhood, going all the way through.
Getting your wigglers, getting your crickets, whatever you're going to fish with.
And there's a little sign, a roadside sign on the left-hand side of the bottom left of the painting that says Live Fiddlers. And then you go up into the middle. It has an illuminated old gas station sign that says B&M Bait and Tackle. And then the storefront with the you can see that the proprietor has just arrived. There's a cart. He's just putting out his merchandise on the front of the store. The lights are barely on, and then there's a dramatic red sky off in the distance beyond the tree grove that covers the store with the bright red and orange and the red clouds, stripes of clouds in the sky. And I just, to me, it identifies not only the Lowcountry, but Florida. I mean, St. John's River area where this is, that's all about fishing. The great American artist Winslow Homer did paintings of the St. John's River because he went there as a sportsman to go fishing. And so, it identifies the place, but it's also, it envelops the history and the culture of the place.
Let's just kind of talk about what's next for Wes Fraser.
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure that I have fully resolved it. My wife and I have recently bought a place in Costa Rica. I have built an incredible studio on a mountainside in Costa Rica. My plan is for it to be my refuge, the place where I can go for peace and quiet, to go away from the noise that is all around, where I can really work on seriously pursuing my painting. It's also a place where I will hopefully become stay fit as I grow older. I'm also interested in painting Latin America, perhaps some of South America. I see that as an unchanged landscape, or perhaps I'll catch it at the cusp of change, especially in Costa Rica. Things are changing. Change has always been something that dramatically influenced what I painted. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. And I'll continue to paint here. I will continue to have a home in the Lowcountry. I also enjoy painting in Europe and around this country. So traveling and finding inspiration is a great reward for me.
Okay. Well, I don't want to put you on the spot. When you talked about getting peace and quiet in Costa Rica, is the Lowcountry getting too developed for you?
It's become pretty busy. I don't find natural landscapes anymore. Only a few places, the protected places. I don't do landscapes with docks. I've done what I want with the Lowcountry.
Okay.
There's still some places where I can paint, and I will continue to paint there. on some of these islands that are protected, some of the big land holdings that people have. I find inspiration, find places to paint. I think an artist needs to grow. I'm not one to say, well, this is what I do, and I'm going to repeat myself over and over. I'm always looking to grow, to find new inspiration. And I also think that my painting is better now than ever before. I continue to grow as an artist, as a painter, as a craftsman in that pursuit. And so I'm going to go full force for the rest of my life.
Wonderful. That's great. Wes Fraser, South Ghana artist. We've been talking about his work and his new book, Painting the Southern Coast, The Art of Wes Fraser. And Wes, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal.
Walter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Having a conversation with Wes Fraser is like having an open book on the Carolina Lowcountry. Whether it's flora, or whether it's the sea, or whether it is a vanishing urban landscape, it's an incredible chronicle of a world that, in many ways, is disappearing. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.